Just to get going, I'd like to thank Eric for inviting me to do this. It was a little bit of a surprise, frankly. Last year when they were talking about putting the symposiums together, I said, well, I'd like to be on the committee that decides who the speakers are. I wasn't expected to be on the speakers list. So I'd also like to recognize and thank my colleagues, Dave Parrish and John Cundiff, for their inputs to my thinking. My interactions with them have been very helpful professionally and from helping me frame some of these issues. Just to give a little background, I had done some work with Dave and written some things with him that led to a call from CAB Abstracts to put together a review for a new review series that they were putting together. And so that led to a publication on challenges for deploying dedicated large-scale bioenergy systems. That's a 2007 publication, and it's really helped me think about some of the issues in ways that I hadn't thought about it when I was simply thinking about some of the agronomic aspects. And so I interacted a good bit with John Cundiff in that process of writing that paper, and I think that'll be reflected in my presentation today. So now, with dispensing with those niceties, and before I really get into the heart of my talk, I'd like to ask a question. Why are we doing this? If I took a poll of the people in this room, I'm guessing that there's going to be, very different answers amongst you. It's not going to be a unanimous decision about we're doing this, whether we're doing this for, say, environmental security or national security or economic security. And I would like to put forth the idea that I think we really need to take economic security as the fundamental purpose for doing this. And then our national security imperatives and our environmental security goals can fall in line with our economic security needs. I think if you look at the political debate, things like environmental security come and go, as do things like national security. But economic security is probably a good place we can start off with, but there may be some challenges there too, so we'll talk about that. All right, so every good talk, maybe bad talks too, but a good talk should have an outline. And so in talking today about the challenges for switchgrass to energy systems, I want to address the agronomic, logistic, and I will touch on, but not really directly address, conversion challenges, and then I'll speak to some of the challenges that are external to the system. Now, I'm guessing that all of you are looking at that and saying, well, that's pretty simplistic, and, these systems don't exist in isolation, so, how can you really do that? And, I was discussing this issue with a colleague of mine, Steve Hodges. He's very interested in systems dynamic modeling and interactions amongst pieces of the system. And he said, well, John, it's really pretty simple. Now, don't try to read this. Please don't try to read this. Just take my word for it. At the top of this schematic or model is government policy on biofuels. And government policy has impacts on desired biofuel production capacity, which may be a driver for biofuel demand, and there are impacts on production and co-products, blah, 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 blah. And then on the other side of this thing, maybe its policy is affecting planting incentives, and food and forage prices will have plus or minus effects on the plant for feedstock planting attractiveness, and on and on, and you get the picture. And then, as we bring together these systems in a mature way, we would hope that they not only meet these biofuel production goals, but they also meet some of these other outcomes that we're interested in, such as, say, carbon sequestration or nutrient cycling or community benefits in rural economic development. So you have to understand, I've been struggling under this cloud for a while now, and so maybe the thing for me to do is just go back and take the reductionist approach, and we'll address these things from the purely reductionist standpoint of agronomic, logistic, conversion, and external challenges for the system. So I'd like to start then with some of the agronomic challenges. And I think probably the two biggest ones, really, as we think about them, are establishment and management. And within that context, you know, there's a whole host of these issues, and I probably haven't listed all of them, but, you know, things from cultivar selection and seed dormancy, planting date, planting depth, blah, 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 all the way down to harvest management. And rather than trying to bore you with some thesis on each one of these, I thought I would just kind of pick out three that may be of interest. So we'll start with seeding rate, and we'll talk about weed control and also harvest management. Now, while I'm saying these are challenges, the agronomy of switchgrass for biofuel systems is pretty young, and yet in some ways it's maturing rather nicely. And some of these challenges, or things that we've considered challenges, really aren't so much challenges or unlikely to be very big challenges in the future as we work more with these crops. And the graph that I'm presenting here, or the figure, is one from Mooney et al. It was published this year. This paper is out of Tennessee. And there are essentially two points that I want to make about it. First, in the background, the authors were trying to determine production costs over a 5 or 10 year cycle with these switchgrass to bioenergy or potential switchgrass to bioenergy systems. And one of the things they did was test seeding rates. And you see they tested rates from 2.8 all the way up to 14 kilograms per hectare of seed. And the interesting thing here then is that seeding rate, for the most part, had very little effect on initial first year yield. And that carries over into the third year. So, you know, we're getting successful establishment with 2.8 kilograms of seed per hectare, about 2.5 pounds per acre. So, you know, that has some serious implications when you're paying $20 a pound for seed. And this may be more of a concern for the seed industry if they're looking to make their fortunes in selling lots of seed. The other aspect that I would point out in this from this figure that's that the biggest challenge may be that first-year yield. And there are ways to improve on this, and people like Emily Heaton at Iowa State are working with systems where they're incorporating switchgrass seeding into corn, so they're still getting economic first-year yields. Okay, moving next to weed control. Now, this has been probably one of the big limitations for switchgrass establishment. A lot of problems with annual warm season grasses like foxtail or crabgrass, sometimes broadleafs are a problem. But there are a number of new and maybe even old chemistries that are proving useful. One of these, a study that was reported this year by Mitchell et al., was looking at the use of quinclorac, which historically, as I understand it, has been used in wheat cropping systems. Where's my cursor again? And they looked at quinclorac or quinclorac plus atrazine, and they were measuring, you know, yields of 40% greater in the second year when they had these applications. Now, there's still some kinks potentially to work out. I mean, this is management dependent. Just to show you, Boydston et al. Reported first-year yields decreased by 33% by applying quinclorac. But what they were doing, as I understand the paper, is they were applying onto the seedlings. So there was some direct impact when applied directly to those seedlings. Yields in the second year were decreased or not, sort of variable. So, you know, management aspects that we can work out, but we're making strides to eliminate some of the agronomic challenges for these systems. So, okay, here's the next one, harvest management. Now, you're all looking at me, probably, or looking at this slide, saying, well, come on, Fike, you know, what's the problem here? We all know we should use a single in a season harvest, right? I mean, we want to recycle those nutrients back into the root system. We don't want to haul the nutrients out of the field. We want to improve the feedstock quality by reducing, say, phosphorus and other minerals, alkali, and silica, things like that. So, you know, in some respects, maybe this is agronomically true. And, you know, some of my previous publications and writings would essentially have said that. But, you know, there's a big problem with how you're going to collect all this stuff. And so the purpose of this slide is to address that issue. This figure shows an 8-month harvest season and the cost associated with 8-month harvest season, where you've got land rent, field costs, The next block is harvest costs. The little line right here represents field storage and then transportation. And you'll notice that when you use a two-month harvest season, that is a short harvest window, end-of-season harvest, like we might normally recommend based on the agronomics, what that does is that essentially doubles harvest cost. And it nearly triples the storage cost. Now, the storage cost may be not that great, but it's still an economic burden. So that at the end of the day, you've got $16 more per dry ton incurred by trying to do it all in a short period of time. There's some other consequences in this, too, in that you've got much greater equipment requirements. I mean, okay, you know, you got a few farmers down the road that have some balers, and they take care of it baling through the summertime, and now you're telling them we've got to go out and bale all this stuff at the end of the season. Well, hey, man, I got to have more balers if we're going to really take in all this biomass. So the other thing that this was a modeled study, so, you know, we don't have this all in concrete numbers from field data, but in their model, by doing this sort of two-month harvest season, there are also slight reductions in harvested acres. There are aspects or challenges associated with, you know, wet ground and things like that, and biomass collected was also reduced slightly. So you see an agronomic challenge turns into a logistics challenge. And to add more fuel to the fire, as it were, that becomes even a process challenge in some respects. From an agronomic standpoint, you know, we've increased the nitrogen and the nutrient requirements for feedstock production, and we might also have some greater risk in terms of loss with rain or rot if we're trying to spread that out over the season and we're trying to get harvest in the summertime. But then there's also the logistic issues that are considered, that should be considered in that. Because if we're going to harvest green material, then suddenly we probably have to have higher power requirements for cutting that green material and crimping it so it'll dry faster. And all this leads to process considerations. In some respects, if I have a longer harvest window, that's an ease on the processor's on-site storage requirements, so that's maybe a good thing. But it could be a challenge to the processor in terms of greater heterogeneity of feedstock. And if you start talking to people who work on the biochemical end of things, heterogeneity is not really something that they're all that happy about. So, you know, that could be a problem. So this is kind of one of the few places I'm talking about conversion. I'm just saying that what we do in the field may have implications at the biorefinery, and that in itself, though, will be process dependent. Thinking about pyrolysis system, you know, there may be some greater environmental constraints or emission constraints, particularly if these feedstocks have more nitrogen in them. But, you know, I'm working with a guy who's doing some pyrolysis, and he says, well, bring it on, because if I can take that biochar product, and it's got more phosphorus, and it may have some other nutrients in it that it wouldn't have if you harvested it in winter, suddenly he's got a higher dollar fertility or amendment. So how these systems play out is, you can go back and think about that cloud a little bit. All right, just briefly touching on some harvest and storage technologies that come to play. These are part of the logistics challenge family. Should we chop this stuff or should we cut and bale it? One of the nice things about chopping is that it's going to reduce the size immediately and provides flowability. That's a good thing. Because you've got to think about how are you going to cycle all this stuff from farm to the factory gate. The problem with this is there's no onboard storage. So if I want to keep this machine running, I've got to have this one piggybacking right along. So, you know, I've doubled my labor problems or labor requirements right there. There may be some benefits in terms of putting these into module systems that could be compressed. This is a cotton module here. But then there's going to be questions relative to storage requirements. On the other side of this equation, if we look at cutting and baling, this is a beautiful thing in that it disconnects the harvest from infield hauling. In fact, the cotton industry has moved to pickers that bale cotton rather than bringing it back to these cotton modules. because they can disconnect. They can leave that bale in the field, and that machine can keep on picking. It doesn't have to wait for anybody to come pick up a load or that sort of thing. So what are the disadvantages there? Well, you know, we still need size reduction, and we've got a low density haul here. But we can have reduced storage requirements, at least for round bales. So, you know, what's our system going to be? There may be an issue with feedstock contaminants. If I'm baling this stuff up, I'm picking it up off the ground, what does my processor need in terms of low levels of soil contaminants, that sort of thing? Just a quick idea of some ways this may play out. If you're in the Midwest or maybe on the Great Plains, the large square baler may be for you. But when you get into the Southeast, at least where I come from, we're really challenged by small, irregular-shaped fields of uneven terrain. How are you going to get that stuff off there? Now, there's been some suggestions that we can bring in these square balers and we'll need less of them because, you know, we've got more throughput in the bale. Fine. You've just asked the farmer also to pick up a larger piece of equipment to haul that or to pull that thing. So, you know, we think that the round bale has some real opportunities in the Southeast. In addition to, you know, an existing infrastructure, there's also the fact that these bales shed moisture rather readily, and so infield or satellite storage losses are pretty minimal, particularly if they're just on a rock pad somewhere and they can drain freely and they're net wrapped. So, you know, if you look at this graph, you see that the round baler has better field efficiency as long as our field sizes are below about 8 hectares or maybe 10 hectares. So if it's less than 25 acres, believe me, there's a lot of that in the Southeast. And here's a fundamental question. Do we say that's not sufficient for us in terms of size? We're not worried about it. You're too small to play. Or do we want to make sure that these small farmers or people with small fields can enter the system? And I would make the argument that if we're going to do this thing, we're going to need all of that material, all that landmass. We're going to need suitable logistics systems for the operations on farm. These pictures came from a progressive forage grower, and they show a rather creative way of dealing with round bales. Again, this will be a big limitation for round bales. We don't have a good way to handle these materials to get them from the field to satellite storage, and then from satellite storage to a biorefinery. So this is, you know, a novel approach that this producer's taken. I want you to pay attention to this bullet. The in-field hauling costs more than the baling. The in-field hauling costs more than the baling. So we've got to, if we're going to be effective economically, fuel efficiency-wise, that sort of thing, we've got to find ways to handle this materials. Just a quick aspect on what's an optimum facility size. There's a lot of discussion about that. You know, you get economies of scale as you get bigger, and that's great, but there's also diseconomies of scale for these systems. If I've got 40% of the land base represented by these black dots down here, I can get fairly large and still keep my hauling costs pretty low. But as my land area and production goes down, I can only keep my production costs within a certain range if I keep my plant sizes low. Otherwise, I'm overwhelmed by the hauling cost. So these are important factors that are going to have to be worked out in terms of what's the scale of the facility and what's the land base around it. A lot of people say, well, it's a, you know, you chicken or the egg issue, you know, you just put the facility there and that'll bring all the biomass. Well, it's not necessarily that simple. Just put this in context in terms of scale. We've heard some talk today about production of grain and oilseed crops. This is from a kind of a perspective piece by Richard in Science this year. And he was looking at the global biomass volume required to achieve a 50% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2050. And so he was looking at different densification options. But, you know, what stands out here is if we're going to use bale systems, look at that. We're almost at 100 billion cubic meters of biomass. Where's Valenic? That's too bad. I should have tried to put this in terms of the scale of the Great Lakes. How many lakes could we fill with that? So anyway, we've got a lot of volume that we have to move, and that represents a real challenge. There are ways that we might reduce some of that challenge by using pelletizing or creating pyrolysis oils, and I'm not going to go into that today, but I think there's some opportunities there, and that may allow us to tie into road networks, increase our storage capacity. Anytime we can increase storage capacity, that's a helpful thing for the system. All right, so I'm going to really shift gears now to wind this up, and I'm going to talk about some environmental challenges, three in particular that I'm interested in: environmental fit, some social concerns, and some policy issues. On the environmental goodness of fit question, one ought to ask, what's land conversion's effects going to be on wildlife habitat? Now, many people expect that that's going to be an improvement, but I would ask, well, is that going to happen at the expense of other services? We have people at our Department of Game and Inland Fisheries in Virginia who no longer recommend switchgrass plantings. It's just too aggressive, and wildlife don't do well enough within it. So if we go to planting millions of acres of switchgrass in monoculture, is that going to be successful? That's a real question. I think we may have a way around this if we can work on this next issue. Can we manage harvests over time to provide a beneficial landscape mosaic? What do I mean by that? I guess what I'm saying is, if we are harvesting materials at different times over the season, then we have an opportunity both to simultaneously reduce logistic constraints, to provide patchiness on the landscape that provides better habitat for wildlife. And so there may be some real opportunities here if we can find out a way to do that and mesh this or merge this all with the bioenergy production system. Impacts to water, that's already been discussed a little bit today. One might think that this actually is going to reduce water, but in some respects it may be beneficial in terms of water supplies, because if that feedstock crop is only growing for, you know, so many months out of the year, then it's probably less than some of the it's going to be less active over time than some of our cool season grass crops. So, and maybe then you get into a question of, well, where's the breeder and how much of the season do we want? I'm not sure we're really ready to get to that scale of refinement at this point. What about fire risks? Who assumes the responsibility for 1,000 tons, 100 tons, whatever it might be, that's stored in a satellite location somewhere, and somebody either through carelessness or a deliberate act sets that thing on fire? Or you get a really dry season and you get one of these odd winter thunderstorms and you've got, you know, lots of standing biomass there that's just tinder dry and ready to go. Who assumes, you know, who's going to take care of that in terms of insurance, and what's that going to mean in terms of a biorefinery's ability to meet its production goals? Invasiveness, probably not an issue unless it's grown in some really places like along stream banks and things like that, where it's not normally been seen. And this is more likely an issue in places, states like California or places on the West Coast. I know Steve Franson's doing some work with switchgrass. I think Steve is here, and they're still letting him do it in Washington State. So we're going to assume that invasiveness is not really going to be a big issue with switchgrass. Another question would be, what's the system's waste stream? Now, we would hope, actually, that these systems in the future are not going to have waste streams. It's all going to be co-products, and we're going to find a way to utilize, in the pig industry, they say everything but the squeal. I haven't come up with a good one for the switchgrass yet, but, you know, hopefully we'll be using everything out of these systems, so that's not really a concern. Some social issues. What's to say that producers are going to be willing to change crops? This study by Jensen et al. Was reported on a survey of farmers in Tennessee. The higher the farm income was, the greater, or the more negative the response in terms of their producers' interest to energy cropping. And that makes sense. I mean, if I've got a higher dollar value from some other production system, why would I switch to bioenergy production, which is going to be a high volume, low profit margin sort of enterprise? Will producers venture to this if they get long-term contracts? that's a new paradigm for us. And yet that may be the best way to get into the system. But how does that meet the existing land tenure norms? Most of the land in Virginia, I mean, the majority of the land in Virginia, and I would venture this is probably true for most of places where you're from, most of the land that's being farmed is not owned by the farmer. The majority of the land being farmed is not owned by the farmer. If that farmer wants to put this switchgrass crop in for 10 years, is the owner going to allow that? So, you know, those are real questions that have to be asked and addressed. We've already heard some discussion about food versus fuel debate. And, you know, I think as society goes on some of these issues, that's what's going to the way that the bioenergy industry is going to go. And what's society's greater vision? I don't mean any slight to my colleagues from DOE, but, you know, there's kind of the question of do we follow a DOE versus a USDA model? Because DOE is looking at this, you know, look, we're using lots and lots and lots of petroleum. So we're going to need lots and lots and lots of biomass. And we need these things on a grand scale. And, you know, what's our economies of scale here? So they're thinking about this as a large industrial process, or at least I think that's where they've been historically. And USDA says, well, you know, we need to think about this in terms of rural development, and we need to have these smaller systems. And so I get back to, this should have been in quotes probably, but my colleague Dr. Cundiff says, you know, we're going to make people hay serfs, or you're going to have the opportunity to be hay barons. Is society prepared for this change? I mean, if you started calculating out how much biomass it's going to take and how many trucks it's going to take just to deliver the feedstock in an hour to meet a certain facility size, it gets to be pretty big just on that one factor alone. Are we willing to trade higher food costs for rural development, energy security, or climate change? We're fairly tax-averse in this country. I'm not sure whether our populace really understands these issues and sees them as a beneficial thing necessarily. Lastly, getting to some government policy issues, I would say that we need a consistent long-term policy to put these systems into effect. And I ask the question, is that possible in today's political climate? The government can be very effective in helping to create market pull by supporting industry development and providing guarantees for feedstock development. Sherrington out of the UK found that the government can minimize risk by guaranteeing long-term contracts. And that, you know, again, get back to this issue of long-term contracts, land tenure, etc. But then a study by Song et al. Where they modeled policy effects on adoption suggests there may be some laws of unintended consequences if we don't get the policies right. And they actually found, by their model anyway, long-term land converted to switchgrass. Finally, maybe a question is, can switchgrass win out? In some places, it may not be the clear winner. I would say that's probably true for a lot of the Southeast. And some of these policy aspects may help drive some of that. If government's willing to front the upfront or help deal with some of the upfront costs and the time delay in getting these biomass feedstocks in place, there may be things like miscanthus, or Ravenna is probably not a good choice, but you see how much more productive they are than the switchgrass stand. So there may be opportunities there that preclude switchgrass from being put in place. So just to summarize real quickly, I would say switchgrass has great potential as a bioenergy crop, but several factors are going to have to be addressed. And these are going to include the agronomic challenges, and they'll have to be met, or they are being met and will likely diminish as the crop becomes more commonplace. The logistics challenges, which I consider the greatest technical hurdle at this point for bioenergy cropping systems. And there are several other potential hurdles and opportunities, but the successful implementation of these systems is going to require a clear, consistent vision, policy, and social will to build this road to the future. Thank you. So the question was, the ethanol industry does not offer long-range contracts. and biodiesel didn't get the, how did you say that again? Okay. The biodiesel credit was not extended by the government. And so, you know, do I think that we can really get long-term contracts for bioenergy for switchgrass production systems? Let me ask you a question back. As I understand it, and help me here, POET is putting producers into, I don't know if it's a long-term contract, but at least they have some contract guarantees, and the producer is also sharing in on the wealth of that product, correct? So what kind of length of contracts do those guys have?
1 year, 2 years.
Well, and when you look at what happened to Verisun, where you know people based all their economic projections on corn at $8 a bushel, that really has a big impact. So, you know, I think there's a role for policy to help stabilize these markets and allow for that. But again, we have to, the answer is yes, maybe, from my perspective.